Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is a special broadcast on America as a postmodern police state. Joining us in this hour will be Professor Mickey Huff from San Francisco Bay Area. He is the director of Project Censored and is on the board of directors of the Media Freedom Foundation. He is a professor of social science and history at Diablo Valley College in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he is a co-chair of the history department. He is also on the advisory committee for the History of Conflict programs at John F. Kennedy University. He will be joined later by William Binney. William Binney is a former high place intelligence officer in the United States National Security Agency, or the NSA, where he was a technical director in charge of a department of several thousand employees engaged in military geopolitical intelligence analysts and the creation of the National Security Agency's mass surveillance program. And after working with the agency for over 30 years, he resigned and turned whistleblower over the unconstitutional and illegal mass surveillance and spying of the American and foreign populations. He's been described as one of the best analysts in NSA's history. Prior to his tenure at the NSA, he worked with the Army Security Agency and was a Russian specialist. He is a harsh critic of the U.S. government spying on its citizenry and has been outspoken regarding the U.S.'s demise into a police state comparable to the KGB, Stasi, and Gestapo, and that the government's massive data collection of phone intercepts, emails, tracking, cameras, and other spy mechanisms is part of a bigger mission to ultimately have control over the population. Let's begin by going over to the San Francisco Bay Area and say hello to Professor Mickey Huff. Nice to have you with us today.
Gary, thank you so much for having me back on your program. Much appreciated.
Mickey, over the years, Project Censored has gathered many hundreds of stories and investigative reports on national and international issues that don't reach the mainstream media or the larger public. Therefore, many of these stories pertain to the U.S. emerging as a police state and the extent of government and intelligence spying on citizens. Now, some of these stories, such as a report by journalist Brian Bugart, reveal the extent to which the U.S. has descended into a dark regime of corruption and fear and paranoia and an obsessive need to exert power and control over the American population, in particular to silence voices of dissent. So I'd like you to share some of the more important and telling stories you have received that best capture and highlight the argument that the U.S. is no longer a democracy, as our founding fathers and mothers would have envisioned, but has turned into a repressive police-based regime that suppresses personal freedom, has little moral regard for a person's life, and no longer values the primary principles of a democracy. The forum is yours.
Well, Gary, that's a long story indeed, and it's an unfortunate one, particularly given the history of the United States starting as a colonial settlement, essentially displacing people and really hierarchically segregating people and acting as if there is seriously a tiered structure of certain cultures and certain people that are exceptional. And that's a term in the United States that's been used for over two centuries to describe the vision that the plutocrats have of America's role in the world, is that it's an exceptional one. And the flip side of exceptional, of course, is unexceptional. So if one is not included in the exceptional definition, then one is unexceptional. And unfortunately, that's a large number of people, whether it was Native Americans, African slaves, whether it was various other immigrant groups, normally people of color, women, etc. The United States has been an incredibly unequal and undemocratic society since its inception. Now, I will say that there have been gains and there have been reforms, but reforms really don't go to the radical root of the problem of inequality. And what we face today in the United States is a direct consequence of how the United States was founded, how the economy really was developed as a capitalist one. And the people that we're now really seeing on the front lines of, and let's be honest, Gary Null, this really is a war of sorts against people within the United States. I wouldn't say, of course, it's a civil war in the guise of it was historically in 1861, but there are many, many cultural and political wars and battles being fought in the United States by the plutocracy, by the upper 1% against everyone else. Bearing the brunt of this have been, again, people of color, women, immigrants, etc. But the recent manifestation that we see of protest in the streets against police brutality, this is a long time coming. I know many observers or many people in the United States, particularly whites, may be taken aback or may not really see where some of this is coming from. And although I doubt that's the PRN audience per se, but at Project Censored, we've been cataloging and covering these kinds of stories for a very, very, very long time. In fact, one of the top stories three or four books ago, we do a book on this every year with Seven Stories Press on underreported stories, the top story in our 2012 book was the emerging police state. And we've been looking at this for look, we can go back. I know we can go back very far, but let's just go back to the George W. Bush years. The Military Commissions Act in 2006, the Warner Defense Reauthorization Act, those bills particularly destroyed the concept of habeas corpus to bring the body, the right of any person, according to the Constitution of the United States and the Fifth Amendment, to be tried, right, and then Sixth Amendment, trial by jury and so forth. That basically paved the way for legalizing or legitimizing ex post facto things like indefinite detention. And when we were talking about torture and indefinite detention and the suspension of habeas corpus, back in our 2008 book, 2009 book, 2010, I mean, we've talked about it every year, unfortunately, as underreported stories. And these are now reaching the so-called mainstream, these stories, and where we have people like former Vice President Dick Cheney saying, quote, "I'd do it again," when referring to things like torture. I'm not sure how far off the rails the society is going to go before the system itself autocorrects or self-corrects, or maybe it, given that that doesn't appear as happening, that's why we see these protests in the streets against things like police brutality. And of course, in this year's book, not only again are we talking about the suspension of habeas corpus, the suspension of the Bill of Rights, the suspension of so many things that people mythically hold dear in the United States, but we are really looking at such a serious lack of accountability. One of our stories in the book this year, people can learn at projectcensored.org, is about the fact that there is no accountability database. There is no actual database on record that tells us exactly how many people die at the hands of the police. And when I say the police, I'm speaking institutionally. I'm speaking about a fascist mechanism that acts extrajudicially to deprive people of rights and oft act as judge, jury, and executioner on the streets of the United States, like we saw in the case of Eric Garner, like we see with Michael Brown, like we see with Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa, California. These are not simply mistakes. This is the sadistic judgment of people on the streets that have the role of policing to protect and serve communities that have, in fact, more been predators of the communities. Are all police doing these things? Of course not. But the institution and the way in which the system has been created and the grand jury system, right, the way in which that's institutionally been created, it works against people in the United States. It particularly works against the poor. It works against people of color. And we're seeing that manifest. And we're seeing now unprecedented numbers of people taking to the streets, meaning unprecedented in recent memory, right? We saw large protests at the beginning of the Iraq War, but we really haven't seen civil unrest to this degree in the United States for a decade or so. And it's because the paramilitarization of the domestic police force connected to our foreign policy has really taken us off the rails. And it's a system that's heading more and more into a Kafka-esque kind of gulag structure. And look, I know years ago when we would say these things at Project Censored, people would accuse us of hyperbole. But I'm afraid that the facts on the ground illustrate that this is no longer in any way, even arguably, hyperbolic. This is what we face. This is the system we face. Wanton surveillance and spying, ubiquitous, in fact, spying. There is no such thing as privacy anymore. We live in a society of censors. We live in a society of, really, of a plutocracy where decisions are made behind closed doors to benefit the very few at the expense of the very many. I don't know what else to say other than people should. This latest manifestation of civil unrest, I think, is not only aimed at police violence and lack of accountability. I think it's part of the entire fabric of U.S. culture and the U.S. strive for global hegemony that really is coming apart at the seams, Gary. And I think that the more that people are aware that this is the case, and the more that people follow and really dig to find out that these are not isolated cases where people are being murdered literally on the streets of their neighborhoods. There are far more people, at least twice as many people have been killed by police in the United States than died on 9/11. And we have this rhetoric of a war on terrorism. And unfortunately, many people in the United States live in communities where they experience terrorism directly at the hands of the state. And at Project Censored, again, this has been an unfortunate but consistent theme over the years, that we've tried to highlight these kinds of stories and try to tell people, like, hey, this is here. We are already here. It's, in fact, out of all of this, the one thing, again, that I think is a silver lining is that more and more people are standing up and saying no to this. And it's Black Lives Matter. It's people. It's people in the U.S. It's people on the ground, everyday rank-and-file people that matter. And I think until we realize that we're all in this together and band together to stop the encroaching police state, I'm not sure what hope we have.
I appreciate the overview, Mickey. Do you have any information you can share about the standard requirements for young men to become police officers and whether or not their capabilities of committing violence against citizens is now regarded as an asset to the department? That may seem bizarre, but I'd at least like your opinion. And then, do you see any correlation between the mental illness of war trauma in Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who enter law enforcement and the rise of police brutality? In other words, what they're experiencing is trauma in the battlefield. Are they bringing that back in the streets of America when they become a part of any of the security forces? And for young adult vets, burnout on psychiatric drugs and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and having a paranoid and violent nature, they would be perfect candidates for the kind of police forces that are emerging now, especially when the time comes when there will be much more widespread protests against the oligarchs running and raping this country. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this, and also in the context of stories Project Censored has covered regarding the mental health of veterans who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, thank you for that question, Gary. On the first count, in terms of people in police forces and the education and training and so forth, it varies from community to community. There are some places where, you know, you go through the police academy, you have a high school diploma or GED, and you can be a police officer. And, you know, this is no longer a kind of institution that was popularized through popular culture with Andy Griffith back in the day, because of the Pentagon's 1033 programs and the paramilitarization of police forces. We're talking about extremely militarized and very militaristic kinds of police forces. Now, there are some police forces where there are degree requirements, where people have to have college degrees, whether it's criminology, sociology, police training on top of that through the police academy. But let's be frank, I think even though when we have people going into the kind of work that police do, I think the framing is significant. But institutionally, the framing of police is to look for problems. Unfortunately, it hasn't been to look for solutions. And what we really do need is a kind of community-based policing where people are really seriously looking out for each other. I think that's harder to do on one level when people are less educated. But the other flip side of that is, too, is that sometimes the more educated these people are, the more they're educated in the means of the institution to be a top-down autocratic institution. And I think that that is leading to trouble. And I know the media, corporate media, amplify certain voices, but the heads of police unions across the U.S. in Cleveland, in St. Louis, that have been speaking out against public protests, and there was a police officer in San Jose, California, on his Twitter account that was basically bragging about how he was going to be at a movie off duty and he would be armed, basically taunting and daring anybody to come and confront him. You know, that's the system off the rails. You know, that's the brown-shirted thug mentality of some, I want to emphasize this, some individuals in the police force. But overall, we have a policing institution that seems to coddle, foster, condone, and protect these rogue elements that are not interested in building community. They are interested in adversarial relationships. So I think that we have a series of problems on the basis of who's going into this line of work and what the institutions are, and that even if people want to do things in them that serve the community, the institution no longer, if ever it did, seem to be focused in that kind of a line of work of protecting and serving individuals or communities. It's more predatory. Now, the other element that you noted, and we've covered this over the years at Project Censored, is the treatment of veterans. And the treatment of veterans in the United States, it's a long, disgraceful one, whether we want to go back to the bonus army of World War I. I mean, after World War II, we maybe saw a shift in treatment of veterans. But in terms of the Cold War veterans and Iraq War veterans and so-called War on Terror veterans, these are young people that have been left out to dry. The record levels of suicides among these people and the fact that in the Senate they recently just shut down any real effort to deal with veteran suicides. I mean, we have more people dying of suicide, veteran suicides, than we do dying in actual combat situations. And again, I would also underscore that these are unnecessary combat situations unless one looks at it plutocratically, oligarchically, in terms of American and U.S. NATO hegemony. But beyond that, these are people that if they're lucky to come home from these theaters of war and conflict, they're very damaged, and the Veterans Administration has been very loath to deal with, handle, treat, and help veterans. They rank at the highest lists of people who are homeless, who are unemployed. You know, I teach outside the San Francisco Bay Area. I have a lot of veterans. And they're just like anyone else. They're people that want good things in their lives, but many of them are shattered from their experiences. Some of these people take the few opportunities they have, which are in the police force, and they take their skills or they take their training, where they were just told essentially that these people from country X are out to get you, and they take this kind of mentality onto the streets of America. And the police, again, have this adversarial, warlike mentality. Some of the people that have veteran experience, again, may have a hard time differentiating between that. We certainly saw that with Eric Gelhaus, the Sonoma County sheriff, that killed Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa, California, for holding a toy gun in a park or walking down the street near a park. The man that shot him dead within 8 seconds is a self-proclaimed weapons expert who taught courses in how the police can get away with murdering civilians. I mean, that in and of itself sounds like an atrocity, let alone what he did to Andy Lopez. And so this kind of rogue element that we see coming from the foreign policy of hegemony, characterizing the other, demonizing people, devaluing human life to the point to where it really is not, it's like a video game. And then when some of these people are coming back and they are looking for opportunities and they end up serving on police forces, they bring some of this inhumane, barbarous behavior to the streets, where we see, like the boy in Cleveland, the 12-year-old boy being killed. It was again such a horrible analog to what happened to Andy Lopez in Santa Rosa, California. But this guy's back on the streets. These grand jury systems and these internal investigations almost never find the police accountable. And one of the big chapters and studies in our censored 2015 book, Inspiring We the People, by Peter Phillips and Diana Grant, is on so-called justifiable homicides. I say so-called, and I put that in aerial quotes, because this is called justified homicides and their impacts on victims' families. And this was so timely. This has been years in the making, this study. But it was so timely that Andy Roth and I, the associate director of Project Censored, we put this on the website. This is a free, most of the stuff we have is free online at projectcensored.org. We encourage people to read this law enforcement-related death study because it interviews over a dozen families who have been associated with police violence, and there is a disturbing trend how they've been abused, treated by the police, lied to, marginalized by the corporate media, and their stories are not told. And that's, again, all part and parcel of the way in which we treat the victims of U.S. foreign policy and warfare. You know that U.S. taxpayers are on the hook for killing not just the 3 to 4 million people in Vietnam over that debacle in the Cold War, but in the recent history, in the last 24 years, the United States has been responsible for the deaths of over 3 million Iraqis, generating 5 million refugees. Now, if you take a culture that has that kind of disdain for human life, it shouldn't surprise people, unfortunately, that this is the way we treat people in the United States domestically. We treat people this way across the oceans. We treat people this way here in the United States. It's a sheer travesty, and I think that the dots are just begging to be connected from the surveillance and police state to a culture of wanton distraction so that we can't focus on how these problems have emerged and what we can do about it. I'd say that we're really at a tipping point here in the United States, and I also think that people around the world are wising up to these affairs, and I'm not so sure how long this can continue. I'm afraid it's an unraveling catastrophe, and I'm very hopeful that these protests, the civil disobedience, I am hopeful that it will lead to community dialogue and discussion, and I think that it's only going to come on the local level, Gary. I don't think we can look to national leadership where we have a supposed post-racial America with the first African-American president who has been almost silent about these wanton acts of violence and crimes. I think that we really have to take matters into our own hands as a society to build community dialogue and discussion, build an emphasis on community policing, and really start to take back what we want out of our society and move forth with dignity and respect.
Professor Mickey Huff, Mickey, thank you for being on. We didn't have a chance, we don't have the time, but I know you also have concerns, as I do, as how our major media, which has refused to frame police brutality accurately and within a moral context, and I believe that the message that is sent to the public when police officers are repeatedly exonerated in their actions and the victims are demonized is that the police control the evidence, the courts are controlled by the prosecutors and the police. This intimidates the media in order to report stories favorably about our police state, and I think that does the victims a disservice. So thank you at Project Censored and for all the good work that you do out there on a regular basis.
Gary, thank you, and thanks for having this program today, and looking forward to hearing Bill Binney.
Good. And that's Professor Mickey Huff from San Francisco. I'm Gary Nall. This is a continuation of our special broadcast on America's a Postmodern Police State. Let's now go over and say hello to William Binney. I gave you his background and bio earlier, a former high place intelligence officer in the U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, where he was a technical director in charge of a department of several thousand employees engaged in military geopolitical intelligence analysis and the creation of the NSA's mass surveillance program. He worked there for over 30 years, and then he resigned and turned whistleblower over the unconstitutional and illegal mass surveillance and spying of the American and foreign populations. And he's been described as one of the best analysts in NSA's history. He also worked at the Army's security agency and was a Russian specialist. And he has been a featured debater. He has spoken with Der Spiegel, BBC, USA Today, and many other sources, and about the role of the U.S. intelligence agency doing what is necessary and then exceeding that and the consequences. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
The national rhetoric that America's have brought states that terrorism is the greatest enemy to our democracy and our supposed freedoms. And this was the message of the Bush administration and later adopted by President Obama with the added metaphor of U.S. exceptionalism. And we hear that on Fox and by the neoconservatives constantly, our exceptionalism, and which trumps other nations, of course. And this has been our mythology, and large segments of the population believe this. However, when we witness all that has taken place during the past several months with police killings, police repression of protests and demonstrations, and then all that we have learned by the WikiLeaks and yourself and others telling us the truth about how much our national intelligence surveillance really focuses upon American citizens, especially those not just in Edward Snowden and his revelations, but if you protest animal abuse, if you protest, let's say, the neoconservative view and neoliberal view, you're a target. If you go out and demonstrate, they're going to try to get as much data on you as possible. And the average American finds that difficult to accept. So it's not Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State that is only the focus of our national security state. It's average people. And it's certainly not small regions opposing the U.S. consensus, such as Venezuela, Bolivia, Cuba, or Malaysia. Our real enemies are roosting here at home. And this has been the case for all relatively liberal, open societies that fall victim to extreme repressive forces intent on exerting aggressive force over their populations as a means of control and placating dissent. So history shows this pattern repeatedly, with or without the U.S. influence in the internal and domestic affairs of nations succumbing to tyranny and oppression and totalitarianism. So please begin there. I welcome your comments about who Americans should be most concerned as their greatest long-term enemy, and then how does the National Security Agency and the CIA surveillance programs, as they are currently designed and being operated, contribute to the demise of our constitutional rights, our Bill of Rights, our protections that assure American citizens are living in a democracy. The forum is yours.
Well, that's quite a bit to follow up with, but let me try to do that. From my perspective, what I see is the greatest threat to our democracy since the Civil War is the surveillance program set up by the National Security Agency and the CIA and the intelligence community in general. And in that, I include the FBI, also the DEA, and the intelligence committees in Congress and the FISA court. They've all been accessories to creating this super surveillance state, which I referred to in the past as the Stasi on super steroids, or that NSA is now the new Stasi agency. simply because they're keeping this data, this files on every citizen in the United States and everybody on the planet that it can possibly get information on. So it's not just, it all started with U.S. citizens. That's why I had to leave NSA. I couldn't be a party to that. So I had to get out of the agencies at that time. And it's only gotten worse over time. Bush was bad to start it off, first of all, going to the dark side. Like Vice President Cheney said, we have to go to the dark side. We never had to go to the dark side. There was no reason to ever do that. I mean, we had the capabilities to stop all kinds of terrorist acts. We just didn't. It didn't cost enough money, so they had to have programs that would cost money so they could build empires, and that's really what they were after. And that basically set the tone for all of the follow-on programming and the development of this super secret, top secret America that the Washington Post had published about a year ago. They had a three-part article called Top Secret America, and they listed all of the facilities that were built across the country to support the intelligence of collecting bulk data on everybody on the planet. And that really was what everybody was after in Washington, to build up a much bigger, greater intelligence community. And they spent, since 9/11, close to $1 trillion to do that. And that, to me, is the greatest threat to our democracy since our Civil War. I mean, there's no greater threat to individual freedom than having a central government that knows everything you're doing. I mean, that is the KGB, the Stasi, Gestapo, SS, the techniques that they have used down through time. This is nothing new. This is the kind of thing that totalitarian states have done from the beginning of time. So, I mean, you know, it's not a question of not recognizing what's happening. I mean, I had worked the Soviet Union for almost 30 years, and to me it was just outright obvious what they were doing when they started these programs. I mean, it was very clear to me from the very beginning that they were headed down this totalitarian path. And so I've viewed that all along as the greatest threat that our democracy faces. It's from within. And keep in mind, as I always point out, that the oath of office for everybody in Congress and the president and everybody else is to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. And that includes them if they are a part of the enemies of the Constitution. They need to reexamine what they're doing and why, and that they're violating their oath of office. That's the way I view that.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Although most Americans, I believe, are unaware of your truth that you just stated, that they're being spied upon, or at least having their personal data and emails and phone calls gathered and shared with people or corporations or government agencies that they know nothing of, few understand how this data can or cannot be used in a court of law, nor do they know about how information is intentionally laundered to indict people. Would you please explain the laundering of personal data, how it works, and including how it is used to arrest people? And then have you commented that the before on the primary use of NSA spying programs to assist law enforcement, which would contribute to the U.S. now being a police state that you just mentioned, and explain further this relationship between the NSA data surveillance and domestic law enforcement and its function in policing Americans in order to impose some kind of, I would say, fascist order upon the average citizenry?
Yes, I mean, as a little background, you know, after the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union fell apart. It was in the after 1990, I mean, NSA was looking around to find out who they could find that would be a good customer. So they needed a new customer for all their effort. So they had to look around, and it ended up that they thought they could use the terrorist program and international crime as a way to get to that and have a large customer set. That is all the police forces in the United States and around the world, through the mutual law enforcement agreements and treaties, the MLAT program, where FBI and DEA cooperate through the through the diplomatic channels with the law enforcement around the world. So that was a very large customer set that they thought they could capture, and certainly to do that, you see, you had to collect all of the data in the world on everybody. That then gets down to the point where you're doing individuals, not groups of individuals who are involved in some terrorist act or governments or militaries and things like that, which was a much more focused problem. Instead, they had to have a general acquisition of information to satisfy the customer set of law enforcement. And that's what, Director Mueller of the FBI said in his interview with Bart Gellman in March of 2011 in Time magazine. He said they'd been using the Stellar Wind program since 2001. Well, the Stellar Wind program is the domestic spying program, pulling in all the emails, phone calls, recording phone calls, collecting and storing any kind of digital communications of U.S. citizens. That's simply the name of the domestic part of that. There's also a foreign part that covers all the rest of the people in the planet. So that was the whole point of them building an empire. That meant you had to have build all these storage facilities, like the large one in Utah, to store all the data you're collecting. Then you had to put in place the capability to acquire the data as it was communicated. Now that means going down the fiber optic networks and. The main program they used to do that is Fairview. Fairview is basically AT&T, and they have on the order of 80 to 100 fiber optic taps inside the lower 48 states of the United States. If you go on Wikipedia and look for Fairview NSA, you'll find the slide that was released from the Snowden material that showed all the fiber optic taps inside the United States. For them to collect data off the fiber networks. And that's why, with that bulk acquisition of information on U.S. citizens, that they had to build Bluffdale and other facilities. They opened up, they are building another one on Fort Meade, a 600,000-square-foot facility to store data. They broke ground for that last summer. and so now that's another one that they're building, and they have to build more. So in order to build an empire, and once you start acquiring the data, you got to build these storage facilities, then you have to build all kinds of communications to get the data there and back and get query the data from your analysts. You have to have contracts to manage the maintenance and communications of the network around the world to make sure people through X Key Score or IC Reach could get into those programs and pull out the data they wanted. So that made it how you build an empire and make yourself much bigger, and that's really what's been going on here. Instead of looking for efficiencies and solving the problem, they wanted to build an empire, and that was their objective. And so that's why I referred to them trading the security of the people of the United States and the rest of the free world for money to build this empire, which they currently have.
I have two interconnected issues. One is recently I watched on Al Jazeera Ray McGovern in a debate with the head of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee, and McGovern said that, you know, you knew what they were doing, and the man said, yes, we all knew what they were doing, and you didn't come forward. And I've heard this from Jay Rockefeller. I've heard it in different times and different people on these committees. Now, when you take the total amount of senators and representatives on the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees, and you look at when was the last time any of them chose to come forward and say they are doing things that are illegal and against Constitution. Instead, they say, well, I'm prohibited from saying anything because we agreed that we wouldn't talk about it. And that now that it's all coming out, now that it's being exposed, I'm saying, why don't we hold every single member of every one of those committees, House and Senate, responsible for their moral and fiduciary responsibility? They did not do what they were supposed to do. And there's also treaties that supersede our criminal court system that would protect them. If you see a crime, if you know a crime is being engaged in, you have a moral responsibility, a legal responsibility to address it. That's part of Nuremberg. So nothing do I see in the way of of anything other than cowardliness on the part of our representatives and all the other people within the State Department, the Defense Department, who engaged cooperatively with each other in doing this over decades. Secondly, is what is the Special Operations Division within the federal government, and what is its function and what is its role in transitioning American democracy into a police state?
First of all, let me address the legality issue here. In Executive Order 13526, Section 1.7, that's the executive order that governs classification for everyone in the United States government. Section 1.7 says you cannot classify, maintain classified, or not declassify material that is evidence of a crime, or material that's used to that is embarrassing to either an agency or a person, or anything that is just in general illegal, like, for example, fraud, corruption, waste, and abuse. You cannot classify and maintain it classified. You have to declassify it, in fact. That's what that executive order says. And most of what they've been doing and keeping classified is, in fact, a violation of law or the Constitution. Now, what they've done over time, which is what totalitarian states have always done, is try to slowly and gradually manipulate the laws or the people to think that it is in fact legal for them to do what they're doing. That's what they did with the FISA Amendments Act, the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, and so on. It's to dupe the public into thinking they're doing something legal. And that's what the Nazis did in 1933 and 34, and that's what the Stalin did. That's what they all do. This is typical. If people read their history books, or maybe they don't read them anymore, this is very typical. And what they're doing with this material is using, for example, and Reuters reported this back in August of last year, that the Special Operations Division that was set up within the Drug Enforcement Administration was specifically tasked to look at NSA data to find criminal activity. And what they did with that then was they would use that material to pass to state and local law enforcement as tips to say, you know, go here and in this parking lot, wait for this person to pull in, and then go arrest them, and then bring the drug dogs in and find the drugs. And that's what they've been doing. And what happens after that is you see the material they used was from NSA acquired without a warrant, so it's not admissible in a court. So now they have to do a parallel construction. And that means that they use normal law enforcement techniques and investigative procedures to find the material. Of course, it always helps that they know where it is to begin with. So it makes them look really efficient, and they go find that material, and then they substitute that material for the NSA material in a court of law when they go to try these people. Well, I mean, that's a violation of their constitutional rights to challenge discovery of data against them in a court of law. And it's, in fact, subverting our entire judicial process. And they're not just doing it for us. They're doing it around the world, because everybody in the world, every police organization that has a relationship with the FBI or the DEA can experience getting this material, but have to do a parallel construction because they won't be given the original material because it came from NSA. So I've been calling this entire procedure, since I read about it last year, a planned programmed perjury policy run by the Department of Justice of the United States, because after all, that is perjury. If you or I did that, they would have us in jail in a minute. Well, I mean, this is our government and what they're doing. So, you know, I think they're destroying our entire democracy from one end of it to the other. They're violating all the Constitution, and in fact, all the senators, if they wanted to, could stand up on the floor of the Senate and read all of this stuff out of these secret documents into the open record for people to understand what's happening. They cannot be charged with criminality for doing that. That's a part of their constitutional right. They could do that if they wanted to.
Well, I would like to see Elizabeth Warren go on the record at going after these people. I would like to see Bernie Sanders go on the record going after these people on these issues. They've gone on other issues, and I certainly respect that. I haven't seen them speak out on these issues that we're discussing. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, it's their constitutional duty to do that. It's their oath of office to do that.
It's very easy for someone to say we're against crime. Everyone is. You'll get a consensus.
Right.
We're against, you know, abuse of women. Everyone will say yes. But then be specific. Go after the CIA. Go after the FBI. If you really are there to serve the public, do that. It's easy to say you're going after Wall Street bankers, and we should, but that's an easy prey compared to going after these 17 different agencies and then subcontractors. And let's talk about that, because all told, there are estimated over 1 million people who are directly linked and work for national security operations, including thousands of private corporate contractors involved in intelligence operations who have little to meaningless oversight, and we don't know what they're doing with that. And also, why are we not seeing more whistleblowers? People such as yourself, Manning, Drake, Thomas Drake, Snowden, almost all, to me, are anomalies, because persons working with security clearance under great threats if they go public, or because the intelligence apparatus has been built upon a culture of fear. Could you address that, please?
Yeah, that's fundamentally what they're doing. Is they're going anybody who is a whistleblower. They go after them as hard as they can, and the reason they do that is they want to keep everybody inside the government so afraid of doing anything that they'll just keep quiet. They want to silence any kind of opposition. This is typically in the totalitarian states. That's the way they do it. This is not a democracy in this sense. In the intelligence community and the spying mechanism inside our country, we have no democracy whatsoever. I mean, it's just I'm waiting for them to come after me. So one time or other, they're going to do this. So, because I'm not going to be quiet. I mean, I'm not going to sit there like the Germans did in 1933 and 34 and be quiet, let everything happen and not stand up and speak against it. So I will not go into the darkness of Cheney without a fight.
Well,
so that's my whole perspective on that. I just will not participate in Cheney's darkness.
It's not just Cheney's darkness. You see, I have to separate out the responsibility of the average American, the responsibility of all of our religious leaders in all religions, to stop engaging in intentional neglect. If you wanted to know the truth about what is happening, you could find the truth. It is not a secret. Now, not to know that means you then don't have to share that with your congregation, because think of the power of informed and outraged congregations that their rights, their phones, their emails are being viewed, every one of them. The pastor, the imam, the rabbi, the priest, every single phone call, every single piece of this, why? Now, you get them becoming awakened. Think of all the social organizations. Think of all the colleges in the United States. If you're bright enough to get a 4-point average at Harvard, you're also bright enough to know that you're living in a police state. But are you going to abrogate your responsibility in order to get that $200,000 starting job on Wall Street leading to $2 million? We live as if we are all smart until we're stupid. And I'm saying, let's stop playing this game. It's not Dick Cheney. It's not Bill O'Reilly. It's not Sean Hannity or the legions of the people who support this fascistic view on NPR, PBS, Fox, and other places, and MSNBC, because their corporate shills, whether it's left or right, is irrelevant. And then the average American then believes in what Rush Limbaugh says, and he's got 13 million listeners, or believes what a Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck says. So if they're inaccurate, if these people who are the beacons of supposedly the enlightened voice, if they're choosing not to be aware, then we're in trouble. So we're looking at a whole nation that has got to awaken to the problem, or you will be taken away along with others. And they won't care, they won't know, or they'll even be made to believe that you deserve to be taken away because you were a threat to real democracy. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, well, that's I agree with virtually everything you've just said. I mean, I put it on Cheney because Cheney was kind of the point of starting this. I mean, he was kind of the one to initially instigate this. So I focused back on him. But you could go back through history, back to Nixon. I mean, Nixon tried to do a very similar thing when he was president, but, I mean, he could only do so much, and at the time the technology wasn't there to be able to support the massive scale of what's going on today. I mean, he only did an infinitesimal amount of what they're currently doing, and he was impeached for that, too. So So yeah, I absolutely agree. But there's that tendency to go along to get along, and it, within the system. So you kind of acquiesce to the power positions and the people in power to accept the kinds of things that they want done as probably the right thing. Maybe you don't know enough, you know, you, or maybe you just want to trust your government. Well, you cannot. Democracy is not something, it's not on trust. You have to verify and continue. It's an active thing. You can't simply sit back and acquiesce to things and hope that everything will work out. Democracy requires participation and active participation by everybody involved.
I absolutely agree. William, my last question for you. There are many critics and commentators scrutinizing the repressive policies during the Bush and Obama administrations, and they would say that the policing of and spying on Americans is all about money, power, and greed. Totalitarian regimes that you mentioned develop in order to protect certain interests and keep certain activities in strict secrecy, and the public and the international community is kept in the dark. What do you believe is the big secret the government wants most kept, and which, therefore, requires our extensive surveillance programs?
Well, it's kind of hard. They're trying to do many things at once, and I think probably the idea of how closely they're tied with industry and how quickly or how many things they work with, how much the intelligence community is becoming the driver of our government decision making, is probably one of the things that they want to keep most secret. Simply because, you know, who would want an intelligence? You can't trust these intelligence agencies. I mean, I worked in them, so I know you can't. I mean, the vast majority of people involved are good, hardworking, dedicated, patriotic people. But the core of the management gets corrupted at certain points, and they tend to think that they know better than anybody else, and so therefore they have to do what's necessary to protect the country, no matter what the cost. Whether it's internally causing our loss of our freedoms or whatever, they will do whatever it takes. Like, they'll torture, they'll render people, they'll kill people, they'll drone them, they'll do double strikes, a double tap, killing just innocent people coming to help after the strikes. I mean, those kinds of things show you how the depth of the loss of moral code in what these intelligence agencies are willing to do and how they will execute them without objecting. And anybody who does object gets silenced in any way they possibly can do it. And that's why they can keep everybody in line, and that's a totalitarian state from beginning to end.
If you pull back, and I'm sure you have, in these years since you have been challenged for being a whistleblower, and you look at the larger picture, at some point you have to say, this is just insane. We don't need these massive, privatized, militarized corporate interests spying on Americans, because once they start, once one of these agencies gives contracts, it never ends the contract. Whatever amount they gave this year will only double or triple in the near future. Every one of these corporations that have the connections through their Defense Department or legislators, former legislators, current legislative aides, they're all connected in some way. They all get reciprocal profits in some way or benefits. And yet, if you ask, do we need all this? How much do we need to really be safe? You would find it's probably less than 10% of what we're spending. And yet the average American is excoriated if they suggest cutting a penny out of the National Defense and Intelligence Authorization budget. Shouldn't we be defunding these groups and closing down these companies in order to also have a chance of taking back our freedoms?
Yeah, I would say that that's absolutely essential. I mean, after all, it was Ronald Reagan who said there's nothing closer to immortality than a government program. So it's the same kind of thing. Once you start something, they like to keep it going ad infinitum, because that builds an employment program and a budget and also an empire. So, yeah, we have to, in any way possible, defund these activities.
Well, that takes grassroots, and we would like to see power brokers, people who are retired CEOs who no longer have an allegiance. They've gotten their money, they put in their time. Now let them be free to come forward and address real issues, not just bottom line return for stockholders, but our freedoms. We need to stop hearing the contradiction of those who claim to be patriots on the right, but are not patriotic when it comes to defending our Constitution and Bill of Rights by stopping the military-industrial complex. There seems to be a great cognitive disconnect. But I thank you very much for all that you've done and the sacrifices you've made on behalf of all of us. We commend you for your courage.
Well, thank you.
Wim Binney, and a high-placed intelligence agent, one of the best and brightest at the National Security Agency for over 30 years. He had thousands of employees under him, and yet he saw how our national security mass surveillance program was illegal, unethical, and unconstitutional, and he had the courage to come forward and tell us. And as you heard him say, today we're no different than the KGB, the Stasi, the Gestapo, and he will not stay silent. They're going to come after him. They're going to go after Chris Hedges. Mark my words, every person who is an activist or an advocate will be targeted, has been targeted. It's just the opportunity for them to make that move. When the media has the American public so conditioned to believe that anyone who speaks out against anything the government or corporate America says is an enemy of the state, they'll know it's time. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a continuation of our special broadcast on America is a Postmodern Police State. In a moment, we're going back into the main studio to raise funds. This is a 8-hour special today. Hope you've been with us since 10 o'clock this morning and listening in and listening with Kathy Davis and Michael G. Haskins. And we're raising money today so we don't have to take a week to raise money. And we're hopeful that this will succeed. I also want to mention briefly that tonight, the new feature documentary, which is qualifying for the Academy Awards, Poverty, Inc., will be showing at the Rosendale Theater on Main Street in Rosendale, New York. Now, that's 15 minutes New Paltz and Poughkeepsie. So I want to see the people living in Poughkeepsie and New Paltz go to it and Kingston and Woodstock. It's close by, and it's a public theater, so they're going to have the film. And then since I'm doing this all day, I'll be on Skype after it's over. And by the way, joining there in the theater live will be Gerald Salante, one of the most outspoken people in America on the corruption of our system. And he's in the film, and he'll be there live with a discussion following that. So Gerald Salante at the Rosendale Theater tonight. He's strong in the film, as is about 60 other major advocates. So you don't want to miss that. So you can call the theater for information. It's rosendaletheater.org, or the number is 845-658-8989, 845-658-8989. And I'll look forward to after the film is over. Now, tonight I'm doing a very powerful and important lecture. I'm mainly doing it to film it. It'll be released in the spring, Living an Intentional Life, how it's time that we all took back our life, took back the power to make the proper, healthy, positive, spiritual choices in our life. And it's all brand new. I've been writing the insights on it for about the last 6 months. And we have been full. We had one cancellation. If you'd like to come, call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. Now I'm going to turn it over to Michael G. Haskins, because I'm going to have to run from our studio, where I broadcast from live and it's video streamed, upstairs to my desk, because we have another program coming on live here, and so I can continue on up there. So for the next minute and a half, Michael G., over to you.